This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the author of the new book, Firefight, the Century-Long Battle to Integrate New York's Bravest.
A century-long struggle led by a black firefighters group called the Vulcans eventually prevailed, but not until Mayor Bloomberg had finished his 12 years.
We speak with activist Larry Hamm about Marilyn Zuniga, the schoolteacher in New Jersey who was just fired.
Fired for what? For allowing her third grade students to write letters to Mamiya.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
It has taken nearly one century of well-orchestrated grassroots organizing to squarely address rampant racial discrimination in the New York City Fire Department. In 1919, Wesley Williams became the first African-American firefighter. Yet by the beginning of the 21st century, with a population that is approximately 26% African Americans, the department still had only 3% black firefighters, lagging far behind other uniformed departments like the police. And overt racism plagued the FDNY. Although women and African Americans had sued the fire department's hiring practices and prevailed in court, the department never enacted steps to eradicate those hiring inequities. A court battle ultimately ensued between Mayor Bloomberg and the well-organized Vulcans, the Society of Black Firefighters. Finally, in 2014, New York City settled a $98 million discrimination lawsuit mandating changes to the qualifying test for firefighters and to the hiring practices in the fire department. The new book, Firefight, the Century-Long Battle to Integrate New York's Bravest, lays out the compelling story of this hard-fought quest to break through a tightly knit culture, in which whites, predominantly Irish, exerted a hold on who entered the fire department. We're joined today by author Ginger Adams Otis, who has been covering local politics in New York City for over a decade and is currently a staff writer at the New York Daily News. Ginger Adams Otis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bring us back, if you would, to the early 1900s. Talk a bit about the composition of the fire department then.
At that time in New York City, Heidi, the fire department was almost entirely white. There were two blacks, actually, who were on the job, but they came through Brooklyn. They kind of got on in questionable circumstances. They did everything legally, but they got a lot of help from the growing black power base that was out there in Brooklyn. And it was pretty much very similar to what it is today. It was mostly Irish, a good smattering of Italian, some Germans, and a few other people mixed in.
What year was that there were two African Americans in it?
That would be from just about the late 1890s all the way to 1919.
Right. And as I recall, bringing it forward, because this is talking about a major victory over a long struggle. There was a point in recent times, in the last decades or so, when there was 3% blacks in the fire department in a city that was, as I recall, 26% black. Is that about right?
Sure, and it wasn't a point. That has been the actual reality for the almost the entirety of the 150-year history of the paid fire department in New York City. At any given point in the 1970s, the highest point was about 650 blacks out of a force of close to 10,000.
Right. I always found it astounding. And I remember when people started to meet the Vulcans and others about this in a city that was 26% black, how you could have a fire department that was 3% black. I thought there would be a slam dunk win. I thought this was done. How could a northern city have 3% blacks in a fire department? I mean, with a quarter. But anyway, that's our story, and that's your story in the book. I just wanted to bring that out to our listeners, that this was an outrage from beginning to end.
Well, Michael actually just referred to the Vulcans. Can you tell us who they were?
Sure. The Vulcan Society is a fraternal organization of black firefighters, and it was founded in 1940 and then officially recognized by the fire department as a fraternal group in 1941. And there are many fraternal groups within the fire department. They do tend to fall on cultural lines, the Columbus Society, the Emerald Society, and so on. Now there's the Viking Society as well. And it's at the time that the Vulcans were formed in the 1940s, it was actually really about kind of political power and kind of working through navigating the back channels of the fire department. Nowadays, a lot of the fraternal groups tend to be more about just celebrating their history and tradition.
What kind of risk was it for the African-American firefighters to form into a group like this?
In the 1940s when they formed, the risk was considerable. The main founder, Wesley Williams, he came on. He was the first black firefighter to join in Manhattan in 1919. And he's a tremendous American narrative, his whole family history, his whole story. When I discovered it, I thought, how could this not be known? How has this not been out there? He's just got a wonderful tale. So he, at the time that this started to form in the 1940s, he had a lot of protections. He was an officer. But there were about 20 younger black officer or black firefighters who had just come on through civil service, and they were not protected. So they put it really all on the line when they joined with him.
Ginger, when I got through reading about Wesley Williams, I thought to myself, boy, this is like Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm.
What an extraordinary person. Or Mumia. I mean, this is a really a giant in American culture. And I wanted you to share with us some of your knowledge about him and his father and his grandfather and his son. What a story this is.
Sure. I fell in love with Wesley Williams as soon as I found out about him. And I thought, I initially had viewed this really as a political kind of whodunit with some major players who we here in New York City all know. And then when I started delving into it and I saw the history that was there, I thought, well, I can't ignore this. So my challenge was, how am I going to weave in Wesley Williams and this just gripping story that he had and make it relevant today to today? But then when I actually started to go through all the documentation, I realized this isn't a beginning and an end story. They're running on parallel tracks, because everything that Williams faced, generally speaking, the black firefighters today still encountered in various forms. So then it became a little easier. And I related to him really through my own immigrant family narrative, because we so celebrate our immigrant tales of survival and struggle and how everybody kind of rises up, picks them up from their bootstraps. And the Williams family, they're not immigrants, right? They're descended from slaves, but still they came here through his grandfather, who was an escaped slave. The Williams family, that branch, came here, kind of did the same thing that millions of other people did who came here who knew nobody. They found a community. They built themselves up. They amassed their wealth as much as they could. They struggled. They did everything possible. And the Williams family came at a really opportune moment. It was just before the Great Migration. So it was the pre-waves. And there was this kind of surge of black life in New York City, and it was shifting from Lincoln Center up to Harlem. And his father got a job as a baggage handler in Grand Central Terminal. And from that seemingly lowly point, they orchestrated really one of the greatest kind of coups, right, in political history in New York City, because they leveraged all of his connections carrying the bags to wealthy New Yorkers to get his son into the fire department. And in doing so, kind of beat Tammany Hall.
It's a beautiful story. It just brings tears to my eyes.
Yeah, tell us more about Wesley Williams. I mean, he was extraordinarily accomplished physically and mentally. I mean, he's probably the best recruit the fire department ever got.
Sure. And actually, one senior press officer in the fire department, after kind of becoming aware of my book and reading some of the excerpts, said, hey, he's our Jackie Robinson. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and I said, it is. It's great that you're embracing him. And I'm glad that you kind of know you have this kind of a guy that you can promote. They're celebrating their 150th anniversary, if I didn't mention that. And I thought, you know, let's get Wesley out in this, because this is a great tale for the fire department as well. And he grew up in Harlem. He married very young. He had a sixth grade education. He was tremendously fit, strapping fellow, not super tall, but just really strong. And he early on embraced bodybuilding before it was kind of a thing, and never drank, you know, was very much about fitness. And yet, of course, he never ignored his mind, even though he had a sixth grade, you know, official education. He read throughout his lifetime and really developed into an elder statesman. He started out as a guy who had to use his physicality to literally brawl his way into his fire department, into his firehouse. But he ended up really this incredible kind of diplomat that everybody came to seek counsel from when he retired.
Ginger, I loved the story about his taking, I think, boxing lessons before. Can you just briefly tell us about that initial encounter he had?
Sure. Well, he actually didn't take lessons so much as he was told that you will learn to fight because you're going down to work with the Irish. And you're going to need to know how to fight. And he used to work out at the Colored Y, And there were some prize fighters that worked out there. They were at that point kind of on their way down, a little bit older, but they still worked out there. And they came to him and said, "We're going to teach you how to fight." And he was really, you know, a tough guy. And he had that one secret advantage that nobody knew about, which was that he was a southpaw, like Rocky. So, you know, he got a lot of hits in that no one saw coming.
But didn't he have to sort of prove himself with one particular individual that they said, let's go down to the basement?
Sure. Back then, it was very common in the fire department, everybody knows this, that back then, and this continued, you know, way longer than they want to admit, but so it was nothing that ended, you know, that long ago. The way that firefighters settled their differences was if they really were angry at each other and things flared, and alcohol was liberally consumed at that time, they would go down to the basement and they would bare-knuckle brawl. And the officers sanctioned this. And the deal was basically nobody says everything. Everybody looks the other way. They don't pack the room, you know, so that it wasn't like anything uneven or unequal. But the two combatants would go down. They squared off. The winner was the first up the stairs. And the loser stayed below to wash up the blood.
Gee. Well, you know, the kind of horrific things that were done to black firefighters struck me. And I wondered whether you'd share with our audience some of the stories of what they did to these guys, you know, once they got into the fire department, just trying to stay in.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, Wesley Williams took the brunt for sure, because when he came in, he was the only black in Manhattan. And his firehouse really did not want that. They considered that a major stigma. They all tried to transfer out, and the fire department put a moratorium on any transfers for a year because they knew they'd never be able to keep anybody in there.
Let me ask about that. They lived together, right?
At that point, it was 151 hours of continuous duty you worked. So they really lived together. Yes.
But what kind of things did they have to suffer when they got
into
the department?
Well, for Wesley, it was really tough. You know, when he wasn't looking, they would take his jacket and slice it with a razor so it would sort of hang in ribbons, but you couldn't see it. So the bell went off and he'd rush to get his jacket and he'd pull it out and, you know, it would be shredded. Chicken entrails in his boots, you know, all kinds of little nasty things. He was the probie, so it was his job. He was the junior man, they call it. It was his job to do a lot of the grunt work and the cleaning. So they would urinate and, you know, expectorate their tobacco into the spittoons as much as possible just to make it particularly nasty for him. And a lot of things like that would carry on when the kind of the next wave in the 30s came in. That's when the blacks started to climb in numbers. And it didn't get quite that ugly, but then they would get into the black beds, right? And you as the black firefighter, you probably were the only one in your house. You had to sleep at a certain bed. It would be the bed, you know, closest to the toilet, the least attractive bed. If they could get away with it, they would try to get you to go into the basement, take your bed into the basement to another room or something like that. If you were kind of in the kitchen with them, and this wasn't every firehouse. I need to be clear on that. There were some hot beds where there was some unfortunate behavior, some ugly behavior, but it wasn't everywhere. But in these really particularly nasty firehouses, they would break the cutlery if you as a black firefighter touched it, and then they didn't want to come and eat after you, so they'd throw it in the trash or they'd smash it, things like that.
What about the guy that was abandoned when he went in to fight a fire?
Sure, that's a tale that Wesley Williams told. It was you know, his story that right in the very beginning, when tensions were really high and he was definitely the odd man out, you know, early in his first year, they had a big fire and he had been warned by some people. So he was stationed in Little Italy, in an Italian neighborhood, and his mostly Irish firehouse wasn't always super popular among the Italians. And they had a guy. I actually went down to the municipal archives, just in case people are wondering how I know these names. I looked up the roster. You can find it there. I looked up the roster of who was in his firehouse because he talked about them in a recording that I got, and I wanted to make sure his memory was solid. So they had an Italian, Antonio Pepe, in that firehouse. And the Italians ended up connecting more to Williams, right, than a lot of the Irish guys. And he was very erudite, and he was well-spoken and well-read, and they, you know, liked that about him. And so he got word through back channels, through the Italians who knew Antonio Pepe, that they were looking to, quote, burn him up some way. So he kind of knew something was coming, and he was aware that he had to watch, you know, what was going on. And they went into a big basement fire, and there was this massive explosion, you know, over their heads, kind of a rollover, a flashover. And everyone drops down, and the next thing you know, Wesley Williams is there by himself with the hose. So whether they deliberately left him or they all just were more experienced and new to skedaddle, and he being the probie that nobody helped didn't know, is unclear. But he did, he says he found himself down there alone, and when he did get the fire out, and when he came up, a chief there, an officer, really let the other firefighters have it, because that was a very, very grave kind of break of the firehood bond.
We're speaking with Ginger Adams Otis, author of an extraordinary new book called Firefight, The Century-Long Battle to Integrate New York's Bravest. Ginger, let's move forward a little bit. It's a 100-year struggle in this book, or more, really. Can you just bring us up to date of some of the current timeline a bit, and when the Vulcan started getting really active, and what a struggle it was against really entrenched power in New York?
Sure. And I want to reassure all your listeners who heard you say that it's a 100-year battle, that it's not a boring 100-year battle, I promise you. I really did my very best to make it as exciting as the people are and as the city and the job is.
You can see by the descriptions of what happened with Wesley that you can't put this book down. I mean, it's really, in some way, an adventure story, a mystery story, but a story of incredible racism.
Right. So when we cycle forward, what we find in the modern era was that a lot of the challenges that Wesley Williams and the other black firefighters encountered were still here today. But of course, today they had a lot more mechanisms to fight back. Right. And most of all, they had civil rights. They had legal mechanisms to step in there and try to stop some of what was going on. So the Vulcan Society had, since in the 70s, brought a legal challenge to some of the hiring tools used by the city, because they said you're using tests that—and the competition is so incredibly high. People outside of New York City perhaps don't understand that you can really get a job at, you know, a Fortune 500 company with more ease probably than you can become a firefighter.
And people should also understand, it's in your book, this is a really good job.
Yeah.
I mean, really good. High paid, good benefits, et cetera. I mean, you can talk about that, but it's just a really good job, and it's not recognized in certain communities. At least it wasn't pushed out there as a great job.
Right. In the 70s, you're coming off of really the civil rights era here in New York City, what we call the war years. You know, there's a lot of turbulence and this and that. And there's tremendous competition for a job that lets you work 8 days a month. Obviously, we don't need to say it carries incredible risks and they put everything on the line. But if you're statistically one of the few that gets through unscathed, you know, you can retire at 40, 42 with an incredible pension. You can have had a second job the whole time that you've been working as a firefighter, because you really only have to work 8 days a month is how it works out. So the Vulcans would come forward in the 70s and say, basically, you're giving us a test. And at that point, they were backed by the Latino Association as well. You're giving us a test that right away kind of makes it harder for us, because the competition's so fierce, we're passing it proportion to how many of us take it, just like the whites. But like 30,000 white people will take it, and maybe 10,000 blacks, if you're lucky, on a good test cycle. And they only really hire every 4 years or so. And you're talking about every 4 years for maybe 3,000 jobs. So your odds are not good, no matter who you are, at getting on this job. And so they said, what is this test doing that's so great that this is how you have to rank everybody, and you have to pick from the highest to the lowest? And the city picks, they go down to like 0.3 decimal points on the score. And it is very hard to legally go to a court of law and justify, be able to say, I can prove how this correlates to your job performance. It is legal for us to do this, to cut it so fine, because we can prove that those slight differentiations actually translate into better performance out in the field. So the city was already vulnerable legally, and they got caught in the 70s, and they had a court order from a judge who said, it was known as the 1-in-3 list, for every three white firefighters, you have to hire one black or one Latino. And that brought the numbers up of blacks to 650 roughly, and that so far has been their pinnacle to date in this city that is almost 26% African American.
And 25% Latino, and what, 10 or 12% Asian. You're talking about a city that has minority white, defined that way, a minority white population.
Before we talk about the litigation, I was fascinated by the fact that at a certain point in time, individuals would be hired over blacks who had felony backgrounds, and there was no documentation of that. Can you briefly talk about that?
Sure. And that was one of the things that the Vulcans, for a long time, tried really hard to, you know, fix in-house, so to speak. And that's always been there. When you pass the test and you get a really high score, hopefully, right, that puts you in the running. Then you pass the physical, and that gets you in the running. Then you have to go through a background check and a medical check and all these other things. And what the Vulcans found was that disproportionately to the numbers who were applying, blacks would get knocked out for certain things. So after the 70s, there was kind of a lull because that was a very contentious thing and it caused a lot of tension in the firehouses. But in the 90s, another wave of Vulcans came forward, another wave of young black firefighters. And they're the ones that I really focused on because they're the ones that I met when I came to the city and started covering this story. And they very quickly picked up on this and went to the fire department numerous times and the city, numerous administrations, and said, hey, you know, listen, we're getting – some of our guys are getting knocked out because on their background check, you know, they jumped a turnstile when they were 16. And that's on their record. And they're being told they can't be – you know, can't come on the fire department. And this whole background, you know, kind of check, how that worked as it came out in the eventual lawsuit was really loosey-goosey, if I can use a technical term, and that they had no human resource standards. There were no minutes. There were no guidelines. There were no protocols. There was almost no documentation. So when the lawyers were doing discovery and they went looking for examples, they actually had a very hard time finding them because there were no records. And that was a big challenge they had. They eventually found a few that ended up playing a pretty big role in the lawsuit.
Ultimately, of course, the test got tossed. And my affiliation, obviously, the Center for Constitutional Rights was one of the lawyers, and my close friend Richard Levy, another, Darius Charney at the center. But talk a little bit about that period, because I kept in touch a lot about it. And the stubbornness of the Bloomberg administration is the one that particularly galled me over a 12-year period when the statistics are exactly what you said, complete absence almost of black people in the fire department. And yet the Bloomberg administration never was willing to settle the case, despite win after win. So talk about that. And of course, the Vulcans made every effort they could to try and do it even without lawsuits to start with. But
sure. Well, one of the things that was most striking to me, having covered this for 10 years, over 10 years as a reporter, more than 10 years, was when this finally did settle the disparate impact part of the case, right? Because there were two charges brought by the Vulcans. But the disparate impact settled in, you know, 2011, 2012, around there.
Explain what that means to people.
Sure. Sorry. So the Vulcans, when they brought their lawsuit and they tried for a very long time to speak specifically to your point, they filed a discrimination claim. They went through all the proper channels. From like 2002 to about 2005, they worked with the EEOC, who did speak to me on the record, which was greatly appreciated. They tried to settle with the Bloomberg administration, and it wasn't even settle. It was just, we want to talk. Can you come to the table? Can we work this out? Is there anything? As Paul Washington, who was at that point the captain, he's Captain Paul Washington in the fire department, but he is or was president of the Vulcan Society, he said to me, you know, we would have settled for a recruitment van. They were so desperate to just do something, get some help, meaningful help, right? Not just, yeah, we're going to recruit. All right, and out of a massive budget, you know, dedicate like 0.1% to recruitment. But they wanted some real meaningful kind of assistance, but they weren't at the same time asking for the moon. They just really wanted some tangible things, and no go. You know, it was not going to happen. This carried on until 2005, and then the Department of Justice stepped in and said, look, you know, you've got – and this is the George Bush right. Department of Justice, right, post 9/11, just to make that clear – came in and said to the fire department, look, you really have a problem. You have a city here that is majority minority, so to speak, people of color, and yet your applicant pool, you know, you're pulling from this rank order of hiring is, you know, really heavily weighted toward whites, and you have not done the validation studies that would indemnify you to some degree legally. You cannot prove that these distinctions mean anything. And it just, you know, really fell on deaf ears. It just did not go anywhere.
The disparate impact was the first point, which is the process for hiring has an impact that basically doesn't allow blacks to get equality with whites, essentially,
sure.
A different impact on blacks. And it doesn't say that they're doing it intentionally, but just that the impact of their hiring procedures have a disparate impact on black people. That was one. And then you were explaining also they had an intentional case.
The Vulcans. Now, the Department of Justice only signed on for the disparate impact, right? They got behind them. They was a co-counsel. They brought that with CCR and Richard Levy. The intentional discrimination, they would not touch. And that fell to the CCR and Levy Ratner and the Vulcans to push that themselves. And what they said was that the repetition of the disparate impact, which the city had full knowledge of and full awareness of over multiple administrations and never, you know, specifically stepped forward to rectify. They said it was so glaring that how could it not be intentional? And they threw into that the other elements from the back end of once you did pass the test, the disparate treatment that they saw among the black candidates. How they were sort of caught at different steps along the way by the hiring process and tossed out. So they made the intentional discrimination charge. Bloomberg really did not like that because he was named personally as well. And I think he was affronted by that. This is my opinion. I think he was very affronted by that. When Garifas gave the summary judgment.
Garifas is the judge.
Sorry, yes, Judge Nicholas Garifas. When he gave the decision of summary judgment in favor of disparate impact, he came back a few months later. He considered all the evidence and he gave a summary judgment in favor of intentional discrimination. And Bloomberg was furious.
Let me just go back to that for 1 second. When we talk about disparate impact, they're saying that the process does discriminate because of its impact, but they're also saying that it's not intentional. The people administering don't have a purpose of discrimination. And what you're saying, and what this judge, when Michael Smith reads us something now, is saying, is that if you keep repeating, if you know you're giving a test and it keeps excluding blacks from getting into the fire department, and you do that year after year, and it's brought to your attention year after year, there's no blacks getting in under this, and you keep doing that, you can assume that there's an intention to exclude blacks from the fire department, which is the point that Michael is about to read us.
So the judge comes out and says that this is what's going on intentionally. And Bloomberg, I want you to comment on this, Ginger. Bloomberg answers back, the judge was not elected to run the city, and you can rest assured that we'll be in court for a long time.
Sure. And Bloomberg doesn't say anything he doesn't mean. I know that about him. He would not talk to me for this book, I should be clear, but I have covered him for 10 years and I spoke to as many people around him and in his administration as I could. And he is a very forthright man and he means what he says and he says what he means. And he did indeed challenge that intentional discrimination finding, ruling, and they took it to the appeals court. And the city did succeed in having that kicked back down because they went after it on a technicality. They said that Judge Garifas had erred, he'd overstepped in kind of rolling the summary judgment from disparate impact into intentional discrimination. And the Court of Appeals, they also argued that Judge Garifas was biased, they felt, in favor of the Vulcan Society and the plaintiffs. And the appeals court basically, and this is a very curious finding, this is very strange, the appeals court kept in place 99% of the remedies that Garifas had imposed through the intentional discrimination decision, which included federal monitors to hire, overseeing, and all of that. And yet, they kicked it back down to the lower courts. They did not overturn it, right? They just said, you're right, summary judgment was not the way to go, and you may proceed to trial if you so wish. And you can try this intentional discrimination in a court of law. And the Vulcans were, let's do it all the way.
I was actually there for that argument.
Yeah.
And I found the judges were outrageous in that argument. I don't know if you were you there, Ginger?
I was there.
Yeah. I mean, I thought this was like three white judges, as I recall, sitting there and really giving Richard Levy, the lawyer who argued it, just hell. I mean, just hell about particularly this intentional discrimination. It looked to me like they just wanted to rescue Bloomberg out of this and not say that this was intentional or whatever. I was shocked. It was 100 years of discrimination and they're sitting up there. These three white judges, I was floored by those guys. I said, these are like, I mean, what are we talking about here? This could be the South. This could be anywhere. Anyway,
what was the outcome?
It was infuriating. But the outcome of that was just what Ginger said, which is they said, he was okay on disparate impact, the judge, but on intentional discrimination, it has to have a retrial. And now Ginger will tell us what happens then.
I'm not a legal scholar and I'm not a lawyer, but I don't quite understand how you can keep all the remedies of a decision and yet say the decision itself was faulty. That escapes me, that, you know, fine legal argument, but that's in what happened. So the Bloomberg administration went after it again, and both sides were gearing up, even though he was at that point at the end of his third term, but he was going to do it. And they were actually in depositions, and they, you know, the city was going to put on a very strong defense. And there were people from both sides that really wanted this to happen, because there's tremendous, almost, you know, it sounds silly when I say it, but tremendous hurt feelings on both sides of these arguments. And there's great misunderstanding among all of the players. Everyone was really entrenched and dug in, and it was very hard to have a conversation. It was very hard to have a dialogue. And I think that, you know, people really hardened where they stood. So this was shaping up to be a real battle, because the, you know, CCR and Levy Ratner and the Vulcans, they were not going to give any quarter either.
Our guest is Ginger Adams Otis, the author of the recently released book, Firefight, the century-long battle to integrate New York's bravest. We'll be right back after this break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Ginger Adam Otis, the author of the just-released book Firefight, the century-long battle to integrate New York's bravest.
De Blasio, at that point, though, you've got to talk about the taxpayer is footing just the skyrocketing bill, skyrocketing, massive legal fees, all the settlements as well that they had to pay. It was well over $98 million at that point, something that could have been settled for a recruitment van in 2000.
Yeah, a recruitment van, and then you said in your book there was another point that I remember when it was negotiated a bit, there was a $10 million offer.
Right, in 2008.
And Bloomberg is the mayor, and he refuses to settle.
Yeah.
And it's not just that that cost the money, but the lives of people and people who wanted to be firemen just not being able to get the jobs.
Sure,
And I'm trying to make out, maybe finish where it finally settled, but why did Bloomberg do this? It doesn't make any sense. The thing was so outrageously racist from beginning to end, and there were settlement offers. I can't understand it. I mean, I always thought, is there an Irish power structure? What's going on here?
Well, see, so de Blasio did step into office and in 3 months settled it with no admission of intentional discrimination, but it was done and, you know, basically kept all of the remedies in place. And now they're moving forward, and the next chapters are yet to be written. Is this going to really make a difference? Will the numbers of minorities grow? How is this going to affect the city? But that question that you just posed, Michael, is the question that I started the book with, because I could not wrap my head around Bloomberg. No nonsense guy, right? Some people like him, some people don't, for a variety of reasons. But he's not known as a wasteful man. He's not known among his intimates as a man who's, you know, outside of rational dialogue. He's certainly not known by anyone that I spoke to as a racist or anybody. If anything, he's a full free market guy. If you're the best person for the job, man or woman, you should have it. From observing him and watching him for many years, that's my take on him. My understanding of this, and when the lawsuit was finally settled, I went to the Vulcans and I said, listen, now you're going to tell me everything that you never told me for 10 years because you were involved in a legal battle and you were trying to, you know, play your cards wisely and you weren't spilling everything to the press. I want to know all the whodunit backroom deals. And they said, no, there isn't any. You've seen it. You know. They got only two meetings with Bloomberg over their entire, you know, over this entire 10-year litigation. They didn't even get that many with the fire commissioner. Now, they were, obviously, this is post 9/11 in the initial years, there was so much going on in the city. This was a priority, but it wasn't the biggest priority. It wasn't the only problem the fire department had to deal with. There were really serious issues as they tried to rebuild from 9/11. And that did play a big role in all of this. But the bottom line that I understand, and this is my opinion, of course, because Bloomberg hasn't told me himself, is simply that he didn't get it. He didn't see it. If he had seen that this was actually racist, if it had looked that way to him on paper, I do think that he would have been more proactive, because that's really not his modus operandi. He is a big delegator, and he trusts his people. And he talked to people from the fire department, and they're the old guard, and they don't see any problem. Their unofficial mantra is 200 years of tradition unspoiled by change. They do not see a problem with the civil service merit system. They really genuinely see that it's colorblind. If you want to come and take the test and you work hard and you study hard and you score high enough, you'll be a firefighter. And that's the same shot that everybody gets. So they view all of the Vulcan's claims as special treatment, which is, you know, these are very bad words to them. This is special treatment. They didn't understand the nuances. They didn't understand the legal arguments. And Bloomberg, I think, really relied on what he was getting from his own people, and I don't think he fully grasped it. And then he did reveal what he thought when he went down to testify for Sonia Sotomayor, right? When she was up for Supreme Court, he went down to speak on her behalf. And when he testified to the Senate panel, he said, I don't agree with all of her decisions, but she's a great judge. She does this, she does that. I really like her. But he said, for example, I don't agree with her ruling in the Connecticut case, the New Haven case. Firefighter case, where white firefighters came forward and said they had been discriminated against because the city had tossed out the results of an officer's exam because the test had been so poorly administrated and poorly done that it left them open to a lawsuit from minorities. And they threw it out because not a lot of minorities did well on the test, and they knew that they could get caught on that because it was a bad test. But all the white firefighters, and I think there was a Latino in there as well, who scored well, said, wait a minute, you're throwing out a test that you gave as a civil service exam. We did well on it, so why should we be penalized just because you, the city, made a bad test and you're worried about an affirmative action or a diversity challenge? And so that went to Sonia Sotomayor. She actually ruled that the test could stand and that, you know, it was okay. That actually did eventually get overturned. But Bloomberg, in testifying, said, I don't agree with her ruling on that case because I think it comes down to recruitment. There are legitimate business practices for why these types of civil service exams are valid and why they're good and why we need them. And we can prove that they're job-related, and the courts should let the cities sort this out themselves through better recruitment. And we are doing better recruitment in the fire department. We're working really hard to bring in more minorities. And we think this is the way you solve this problem, not litigation. And that's as close as we ever got to him actually expressing what he thinks.
What's interesting about that, I think, as I recall with his testimony about Sonia Sotomayor, is the lawyers for the Vulcans had been trying to take his deposition, Bloomberg's deposition, for a very long time. The judge had denied the deposition, saying, he's the mayor. What does he know about this case personally? He goes and testifies for Sonia Sotomayor, and he basically knows the case. And then my office and Richard Levy then go and they subpoena him for a deposition, and the judge says, you have to go to the deposition because you obviously know what's going on in this case.
Yeah. Hoisted by his own petard right. A little bit there, yeah.
Ginger, I wanted to ask you, in the book you mentioned that Richard Levy and I think a couple of the lawyers actually took the test. And the test hadn't been changed in years, correct? But some of the questions, even some of the firefighters taking it, the white ones, admitted that questions were absurd.
absurd. So here's the real crux of this. Now, the Vulcans take it on the chin, left and right. You know, they're just terrible people. They're putting the city at risk. It's awful what they're doing, and so on and so forth. And then within the black communities and the minority communities, there's this really strong feeling of the fire department's a rigged game. You know, we can't get in, and we're not wanted there. And none of these narratives are true. And that's the real sad fact is, you know, neither side of that those arguments are accurate. The real story is the city, like many cities that use civil service hiring processes around the country, and this is a system that's been around for 100 years, right? 100 years with minimal changes along the way, most of them because of discrimination challenges, by the way. These tests that were given were not kind of done by experts. They were not carefully, you know, crafted or thought out with any particular intent. There were warnings back, and I have it all in the lawsuit. It's all in the book. There were warnings back from Mayor Giuliani from city agencies saying, you know, your tests are out of whack. These are no good. What are you doing? And as one of your lawyers said, it was a very compelling argument, if the Yankees were picking a shortstop, would you give them an SAT exam? I mean, that's what this amounts to. You know? And so what happened was the city left itself very vulnerable. And it did not get communicated properly to Bloomberg that you're really at risk. You're going to lose. You have a very high chance of losing. And it's easily remedied if you start, you know, if you basically step up now. But he didn't, and it went all the way down. But the city has these tests that there are, on any given term, there's about 30,000 people on average who apply, right? And they're competing for 3,000 jobs, pretty much 3,000 jobs, right? These tests for decades were just poorly designed, you know, no thought given to them, no care. There are seven qualities that New York City firefighters told the city are really important for a firefighter. Number one is oral communication, and number two is oral comprehension. And yet the city persisted for years in putting people in a room, handing them a number two pencil, and saying, fill this out so you can become a firefighter.
I want to remind people we're speaking with Ginger Adams Otis, author of an extraordinary book, Firefight, the Century-Long Battle to Integrate New York's Bravest. Ginger, can you give us some of the key terms of the settlement and going forward, the hope for an integrated fire department, but some of the key terms?
Sure. So the disparate impact was pretty straightforward and pretty clear. The judge, Garifas, ruled that the city had to go back. There were two tests in question, given in 1999 and given again in 2002. Those were the two really challenged. He calculated with expert analysis that there were almost 300 black and Latino candidates who could have been hired or who were hired but would have been advanced, you know, farther along their career if they'd been hired earlier, if they hadn't run into the obstacles given by these tests. And so the city was ordered to go back, find them, offer them a chance to take the test again, and they had to qualify medically. Some of them were now like 40 years old, right? Because they were maybe in their 20s when they took it in 1999, but they were going to get their second chance. And so we wrote a lot of stories about them at the Daily News, and we called them the second chance candidates. And some of those have now actually gotten on the job. And there's a lot of concern about that. There's been a lot of press about that, you know, it's kind of putting the city at risk. They're not as physically fit. Let me just say that, you know, it's not that every firefighter here has to retire when they hit 40. You know, there are chiefs that are 60 years old. So, you know, it's not like these are valid arguments, but they're being thrown out there by, you know, by a certain segment. But this has had a big change because that right there brought in a lot of new faces. And it's really heartening. Some of those people dreamed of being firefighters, just dreamed of it so much, and they never got a chance. So now they get their chance. That's been one big thing. The other thing that came out of some of the remedies from the other ruling that stayed in place were federal monitors who were overseeing the creation of the tests now and really trying to make sure that they're trying to gauge not just cognitive ability, but temperament, you know, things like that, things that say that, you know, you can be in a screaming inferno with your oxygen tank beeping, telling you you're low on air and you can't see the exit and you don't know where your crew went, but you can hear something come over your ear through the radio and you can follow that order or, you know, you can find a crew member who's fallen down because you can keep your head and understand what's going on. And that's really a large part of this job. So all of those things are now in place. There's more oversight all the way through the process from start to finish. And that includes in these sort of secretive background checks. The proof, though, is going to be in the pudding because the real question has always been, will more people of color come out to take the test? And that's where we're going to have to see, because it is the fire department. One reason that it resisted recruitment, to be fair, is that when you have 30,000 people competing for 3,000 jobs, you don't need to recruit. I mean, you're like sitting in the catbird seat. So it's going to, you know, we're going to have to kind of see as this goes forward, is there going to be more attempts to get these jobs from people of color? And then we'll see how it turns out.
Astonishing, Ginger. This is really a tour de force, and we thank you for it.
Congratulations on the book, the personal stories, the 100-year struggle. I mean, it's a compelling, important book. So thank you very much for writing it.
Well, I have to thank your lawyers as well.
Firefight by Ginger Adams Otis. Go out and get the book. You'll like it.
We have to thank the Vulcans,
thank you.
Of course.
Right.
Third grade New Jersey elementary school teacher Marilyn Zuniga was recently fired from her job for allowing her students to write get well cards to the gravely sick Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is in prison in Pennsylvania. We speak today with Larry Hamm, the founder and chairman of the New Jersey Civil Rights Organization, People's Organization for Progress. Larry Hamm is a civil rights activist, humanitarian, and lecturer. As chairman of the POP, Larry has worked toward building unity among community organizations. The struggle for quality education, employment opportunities, access to health care, and against racial profiling and police brutality are activities that the People's Organization of Progress in New Jersey pursues. Larry has received many awards. Among them are one of the most influential Blacks in New Jersey Award and the Hope Award. Larry Hamm, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's good to be here.
Tell us in a nutshell what happened to Marilyn Zuniga and how you got involved in trying to get her job back.
Well, in a nutshell, I was actually contacted after Marilyn began to experience some difficulties with the Orange Board of Education. To kind of sum it up, she is a first-year teacher in the Orange School District in Orange, New Jersey. She was doing a Black history lesson, and she was examining lesser known, so to speak, leaders in the Black community. You know, everybody knows Dr. King, Malcolm X. She was trying to examine other important people in the Black freedom struggle. And one of those was Mumia Abu-Jamal. Now, she did not do any real in-depth lesson on Mumia. What she did was she picked a quote from Mumia, something like, an injustice to one is an injustice to all. It was something similar to that. And the students had to give their thoughts on it. And on their own, her students, which were third grade students, they actually went out on their own and, you know, did some research on Mumia and found out about him and so on and so forth. So later on in April, when the word got out that Mumia was gravely ill, Marilyn shared that with the class. Someone that they had studied was ill, and they felt sympathy, and they asked her if they could write get well letters, and she said that they could. And they asked her if she would be able to get these letters to Mumia, and she said she would try. Well, to make a long story short, the students wrote the letters and an effort was made to get the letters to Mumia, but the word got out that these students had written Mumia, and I guess the FOP and whatever other reactionary police forces there are got involved, and before you know it, they had gone to the media, and the thing had really blown up. And so the Orange Board suspended Marilyn, and it was at the point that she was facing suspension that Joanna Fernandez, who works with the Free Mumia Movement and is a close associate of Mumia, she reached out to me as a representative of the People's Organization for Progress, which I am the chairman of. And so we made an effort to try to get through meeting with the superintendent, meeting with the mayor. You know, we tried to go through the process to get the suspension lifted, and they were due to take action at the April board meeting, but we had turned out a large number of people to that meeting, and it was just, you know, serendipity, because the night before the school board meeting, we had had a program that we had had planned for quite a while with Dr. Cornel West, and hundreds of people came to this program. So I actually used that opportunity to inform people about different issues, and one of which was, you know, the suspension of Marilyn Zuniga because her students wrote that well letters to Mumia. So many of those people who had come to the program with Dr. West the night before, they came out to the board meeting, and we actually got the board to table the matter. But they put it back on the agenda for the May meeting. We did another mobilization, but we were unable to stop the board from voting to terminate her last Tuesday, May 12th.
At this point, what can our listeners do to help Marilyn?
Well, first of all, we're not accepting this termination. We're continuing to fight. Before we were trying to prevent her from being terminated. Now we're making every effort to reverse the termination. And we're mounting a campaign, you know, to keep fighting for Marilyn's job. Of course, Marilyn is pursuing legal options that she has. She's also being assisted by her union. So she has those two avenues to pursue. But we're trying to build movement of the people in the street, so to speak, to support Marilyn. And we plan to return to the June board meeting. We're planning to attend the Orange City Council meeting to raise the issue there. And we're planning to attend the meeting of the Board of Freeholders of Essex County. We're going to raise this issue in every public forum that we can. Now, in the meantime, what people can do is write letters. They should write letters to the president of the Orange Board of Education demanding that Marilyn be reinstated. What they should do, they should write the letter to the president and to the board, but they should copy. The president of the board is Patricia Arthur. The superintendent of schools is Ronald Lee. And the school board secretary is Adekunle James. So what you want to do, you want to send so that the letter will be officially, will be an official piece of correspondence to the board that would be, you know, would have to be recognized when the board has its meeting. You send the letter to the president of the board, care of the board secretary. Send the letter to Patricia Arthur, care of Adekunle James, the school board secretary. And I would copy Ronald Lee, the superintendent. And we want people to flood the Orange Board of Education with these letters to condemn the termination of Marilyn Zuniga, to demand that the termination be reversed and that she be reinstated. We're going to continue this fight. We're not by any means giving up, because what we feel what was done to her was unjust. Whatever minor infraction occurred, termination is disproportionate to the infraction itself. And we feel this is a grave injustice. That, you know, in a manner of speaking, in the same way that the criminal justice system treated Mumia, in the same way the Board of Education is treating Marilyn Zuniga.
Larry, your work is admirable. I understand that at that first public meeting, one member of the school board changed her mind and walked out in disgust. So we credit you and your organizing for that. As you mentioned, the Fraternal Order of Police, the FOP, the media such as Fox News have really tried to shape and take hold of this narrative, and you're doing a tremendous job of turning that around.
I'm doing the best I can, but what I invite listeners to do is to attend the next meeting of the People's Organization for Progress. This is going to be on our agenda until the matter is resolved. The People's Organization for Progress meets every Thursday at 6:30 at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, 224 West Kinney Street in Newark, New Jersey. Not Abyssinia, New York. in Newark, New Jersey, Abbotsingle. We meet there every Thursday at 6:30. And if people want to get involved in the struggle for justice for Marilyn Zuniga, come out to the meetings and get involved.
And Larry, I just want to give the address for Patricia Arthur, the president of the board at the Orange Township Public School District. Patricia Arthur's address is 451 Lincoln Avenue. Repeat, 451 Lincoln Avenue, Orange, New Jersey, 07050.
That is correct.
Larry, thank you very much for the good work you've done over the years and the good work you're doing for Maryland. And we'd like to have you back on and report further on this case. So good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've done a great job with it.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.